Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. So we are also joined today by members of the Long-Term Care Division. So glad to have them with us to discuss this topic that is really important to people on both of those committees and, of course, to many others as well. First of all, I'd like to remind members to please mute your feeds and use the raise your hand function if you would like to ask a question, and then leave it there, and then the staff will take down your hand if you've done that. We're also, though, going to hold questions until we get through the presentations, and then we should have time to have members get their questions answered at that point after we hear the presentation. So, I'm told that a quorum is present, and Ms. Niederhofer is going to just tell us who's on the call, which members are on the call, and then at the end of that, if you don't hear your name, let us know so that we can make sure that you're marked as present. So, Ms. Niederhofer?
Hi. I have Liebling, Schumacher, Akam, Bierman, Cantrell, Franson, Grunhagen, Haley, Jordan, Keel, Kunish-Pudin, Moran, Noor, and Schultz.
All right. And you're not taking the role of the people who are on the long-term care committee. I'm sure there are probably others who are not members of this committee, but we don't need to take their role right now. But is there anyone else who's on this committee who has not heard their name called?
Chair Liebling, this is Representative Olson.
Oh, okay. Representative Olson is present.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
Anyone else? All right. Okay. Thank you very much for that. So the first order of business is the approval of the minutes of May 6th, 2020. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Cantrell moves approval of the minutes of May 6th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, let's just unmute everybody for a second.
All right, and then make sure when you get the order.
All those in favor of the approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Thank you, and we can remute microphones. All right, so the purpose of today's meeting is to get an update on what's going on in long-term care with the Department of Health and the COVID pandemic. And so I haven't seen her on here yet, but I assume that Commissioner Malcolm is present on the call, and she has some slides too, which I saw that Mr. McQuillan just sent them out, but we'll be sharing the screen so that we can all follow along with the slides. And so Commissioner Malcolm, before we do that, I just wanted to see if Representative Schultz is chair of the Long-Term Care Division, if you had anything you wanted to say by way of introduction.
I just want to thank everyone for being able to be available today, and thank MDH for being here. And we have a lot of questions, so I'd like to get right to the presentation and then get some questions answered.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, Commissioner Malcolm, the floor is yours.
Well, good morning, still barely morning, Madam Chair and members. Can you hear me? I think I'm on mute.
Yes, yep.
Great, excellent. Good. Well, thank you for this time and for the opportunity to give you an update. We have a lot of slides here with a lot of important data, but I'll go really quickly and hope that this is useful information you can revisit and review at your convenience. But really important, I think, for us to kind of set the context and share the latest data that we have on what we know and what we've done and what progress we've made and what work remains to be done. But we do want to leave plenty of time for your questions, Madam Chair and members. So I am joined by a number of MDH staff as resources for your questions. I'm gonna lead through the slide deck. And Madam Chair, I would just say, if you would like to stop me at any point, just please chime in with questions. Otherwise, I'll just kind of move through this as quickly as I can and get to questions.
Commissioner, we're asking members to not interrupt, and we're just going to go through and try to get through your presentation, and then we'll go to questions.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just ask for the next slide then as we go, and thank you for who's ever steering. So let's get into it. As we have been talking about for a long time with this committee and Chair Schultz's committee, certainly, the long-term care continuum has faced very serious and systemic challenges well before this pandemic came along, chronic staffing shortages, and a lot of infection control challenges related in no small part to staffing shortages in all kinds of settings, acute care as well as long-term care. This is infection control has been a major issue in healthcare quality improvement across the continuum for literally decades and continues to be so. And COVID-19 has absolutely amplified these difficulties, made them many times more significant and visible to us all. Next slide, please. So one of the things I really want to start by is just acknowledging the many, many questions around the data and what's going on in Minnesota, and how does it compare with other states when it comes to what's happening in long-term care and COVID-19. We've said from the beginning that we know that long-term care settings represent a particular risk given both the age and the health conditions of residents in many of these facilities, as well as the close living quarters, and the environment itself is conducive to spread of infectious disease, as we see every year with flu and other infectious diseases that we manage all the time and that the facilities are challenged to manage all the time. So the questions, though, of is something different going on in Minnesota? Unfortunately, a narrative has kind of emerged that things are really out of control here relative to other states. And we've been saying all along, we had a pretty strong suspicion, and now finally this week we have actual data to confirm it, that part of the issue has been just differences in how states are reporting. And we've been, I'm proud of the department for being extremely transparent and I think very diligent about reporting COVID-19 cases and deaths and reporting that by setting, with a lot of detail on demographics, including racial and ethnic breakdown, age breakdown, underlying condition breakdown, since this outbreak first hit the state with our first laboratory confirmed case in early March. We are all, I think, under now aware per CDC intelligence that likely this was circulating in our communities significant number of weeks before we ever picked it up in laboratory confirmation. But we have been taking a very broad and inclusive look at what we consider to be long-term care facilities or congregate care settings that include not only skilled nursing facilities, but assisted living facilities, group homes, adult foster care, mental health and substance abuse treatment centers, memory care, and the like, because in our view, those settings all, from a public health perspective, represent some common characteristics and need to be understood as such and managed as such. We've been pretty sure that many other states, and I will say it's still the case that some, I don't know how many, but I've heard up to 20%, of states aren't reporting deaths by setting at all. But among the states that have been reporting quote unquote long-term care deaths or that they were reporting skilled nursing facility deaths only. That was our theory. Now we know in fact that's right. And in part that's because there has been no national standard for reporting. And it was only in mid-April that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services sent out instructions to skilled nursing facilities, but only skilled nursing facilities, to begin reporting cases and deaths to CMS and CDC. Interestingly, there was absolutely no format with that guidance, so no definitions that would be precise as to what to count and what not to count as a nursing home death. But we now do have comparable information on skilled nursing facility deaths. The picture is emerging. We have been since early on making the point that nearly half of the long-term care deaths that we've reported in Minnesota have been in settings other than skilled nursing facilities. So we have believed that if one wants to look at long-term care more holistically, other states' numbers don't reflect that full perspective. If we want to look at nursing homes specifically, it's a smaller number. Next slide, please. So that, and as I already mentioned, unfortunately, the narrative has kind of gotten confused, and there's been really some conflation of nursing homes with long-term care. And you can see some of the headlines here. You know, Minnesota nursing homes, site of 81% of COVID deaths, which is not conflating nursing homes with the broader perspective of long-term care. Next one, please. And here's the recent, the CMS data that just came out a couple days ago, which is looking just at the skilled nursing facility or nursing home data that's now being reported into the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. And you can see there that Minnesota is in the second from the bottom tier of cases and deaths by state. Next one. Again, nursing home data specifically. And here, this is a little more helpful look. The average cases per 1,000 residents, Minnesota, you see there, 49.7 cases per 1,000, which is the right kind of in the middle of the pack, 26th highest. The national average is 62 cases per 1,000. So we are below the national average and about in the middle of the pack in terms of cases per 1,000 nursing home residents. Next one. And looking at the mortality statistics, the national average resident deaths per 1,000 nursing home residents, again, the national average is 27.5 deaths per 1,000. Minnesota is at 12.1. We are the 29th highest on this metric. So you can see that narrative that Minnesota's skilled nursing facilities are doing way worse than anyone else is just not the case. Next slide, please. This slide, there's a lot going on here, but we've gotten the question periodically of what do we know about long-term care residents who have other conditions? COVID is in what percentage is COVID the primary cause of death versus the secondary cause of death or no contribution to death? So these are people who have had a positive COVID test, but when they pass away, the certifying provider, who is the one who determines the cause of death, you can see there in all congregate settings, and it's the case that we don't have information on 11% of the cases, but in 84% of the cases, the person with a positive COVID test, the certifying person upon death, says that COVID was the primary cause of death. But in other instances, something else was the primary cause of death. And now this is up to the discretion of the certifying provider, and we think there's probably some differences in how physicians or physician assistants might be approaching this. If somebody, you know, has, as most people, frankly, in particularly in the skilled nursing setting, do have significant underlying conditions, many may be at the end of life, for cancer or heart disease or other systemic failures, and get COVID, and die. And the question of did they die of COVID or die with COVID is something that's the subject of quite a lot of discussion in the medical community. But we count all deaths of someone with a positive COVID case as a COVID death, even if the cause of death might very well be a debatable proposition, yet they are a COVID positive person, so we've been counting them accordingly. Next slide, please. That one's a little confusing, I know, but Chris Ayersman, who I believe is on the phone, can answer questions on that better than I if you have them. So here, the next slide really tries to distinguish between kind of the cumulative totals that of long-term care cases that we report on our website versus what is currently going on. So what's on our website are cumulative totals since the beginning of our tracking of the outbreak. So over time, since March, 855 long-term care facilities, again, using that broader inclusive definition of long-term care, 855 facilities have or have had at least one case. And of that 855, it's about half and half. About half of them still have active infections or cases, and a little under half no longer have any active infections or cases. So those persons who had COVID were released from isolation, having come through the infection period, or unfortunately passed away. Of the 472 facilities that have only one or two cases, and that's another important kind of break in the data that we think is highly relevant, is that more than half, I think it's close to 60% now, of all long-term facilities, long-term care facilities with outbreaks have only one or two cases. And the remainder have three or more, and some of them have significantly higher numbers of cases. And we'll come to that in a minute. But so of the 472 facilities that have or have had over time one or two cases, 30% of them still have active infections or cases. They're either newer facilities who just recently have had cases. But 70% of the facilities with only one or two cases no longer have any active cases. Of those with three or more cases, as you can see, there are 377 since the beginning of the outbreak cumulatively. A far larger percentage of those still have active infections or cases, 78%, and 22%, even of the ones who've had more significant outbreaks, no longer have active outbreaks. Next slide, please. This chart, and again, this I hope is all useful to you to come back to at your convenience, but this is also breaks down that broad category of congregate living facilities into kind of the major category subcategories, and just shows you kind of over time since the beginning of the outbreak, where the outbreaks have been and how that has been growing over time. So the light blue being group homes, a very significant concern for us now. The purple assisted living facilities, orange or yellow, memory care, transitional care, and other. It's sort of our everything else category. The green, nursing homes. And the magenta there, substance abuse and mental health facilities. So you can kind of see the nursing home picture has been fairly stable in terms of the number of outbreaks, over time in those facilities. And where we've seen the growth has been in group homes. And there is, and just a note here, the most recent week, May 31st through June 26 is not complete data, so that might look like they're it's smaller, but it's because of the data lag, and some of that may actually even still be true in the prior week with additional data still coming in. But you can see where the growth has been: group homes and assisted living, for the most part. Next, next slide, please. So when we look at all this data, we have been taking, I think, a proactive and aggressive approach since the beginning of the of the epidemic in Minnesota, but I think increasingly informed by what we're learning and what the data is telling us. That the interventions that we take in partnership working with these facilities really kind of depends upon the situation. But in every case, when there's even one case, we assign a case manager to that facility to keep to be of assistance to the facility and to kind of keep an eye on it. But what is the best intervention is going to depend upon case numbers, the regulatory history of the facility, if we know they have staffing shortages, if we know they are lacking in personal protective equipment, or if they perhaps are in an organization with multiple facilities that share staff across facilities, and we know there's a sister facility with an outbreak. All of those things would kind of come together to inform what the interventions are, which, as I mentioned, always include a case manager assignment. There are on-site visits. There are virtual visits from the infection control staff here at the department and epidemiologists. Also, we've been working with our state emergency operations center and the supply procurement team to acquire personal protective equipment, not just for hospitals, which was the case early on, but increasingly that group has been helpful in acquiring additional PPE for long-term care facilities as well. Although, as is true for hospitals, long-term care organizations are expected to and encouraged to, as they should be doing all the time for all infectious diseases, procuring PPE through their normal supply chains. But we know that especially with the global shortages that have been going on, that has been hard to acquire. And some facilities are better equipped than others to deal with those supply chain challenges. So the state has built up, is continuing to work to build up stores of PPE to fill in some of the gaps in the private sector supply chains. We also work closely with the Office of the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care and our local public health partners to make sure that those resources are pulled in to assist facilities with outbreaks as well. And of course, testing. And more to say about that in a moment. Next slide, please. So again, kind of back to the data picture here. Hopefully this is helpful to you to understand that we have not been looking at an apples-to-apples comparison when we've been talking about long-term care more broadly in Minnesota versus skilled nursing facility data only in others. That picture is clarifying. So that is helpful, I think, to show what is our performance and who can we learn from that appears to be doing better than we are. No matter what the data show, I want to be absolutely clear that we couldn't agree more that the focus on long-term care facilities needs to continue to evolve and get better and deeper the more we learn. So in no way am I suggesting that this data means there are no issues here. We know there are. We do have cases in facilities. We have facilities that have been challenged with larger outbreaks. And that's of deep concern. And given the degree of community spread that we have and the fact that we know that community spread is what is getting into our long-term care facilities with people coming and going, staff and others, that all facilities should be prepared for this and be assuming that it's just a matter of when they get a COVID case, not if they get a COVID case. So we know that this is a situation where swift action is needed by the facilities and by the supportive agencies who can help them. The governor's plan, which was announced about a month ago now, focuses the action in five key areas. Next slide. And the five things are to expand testing significantly for residents and workers in these facilities, to provide testing support to make sure that testing can happen faster, getting personal protective equipment to the facilities when that's needed, and doing what we can, and this is a tough one, to help ensure adequate staffing levels for even those facilities that have major challenges, and to better leverage our partnerships, meaning our partnerships at MDH with local public health, the ombudsman, DHS, and others, to make sure that we're fully tapping the skills and talents of those partners to be part of this support system as well. Next slide. So I'll go through each of the 5 points and kind of where we are now. So testing. We, early on, with more limited testing capacity, the guidance was to focus only on testing of symptomatic individuals. We, as part of the governor's plan, that guidance was revised to say anytime there is a single case of a resident or a staff member, or when there are two or more symptomatic people that haven't yet been tested, we recommend universal testing of everyone in those facilities. And we've created quite a support structure around that to enable that universal testing to happen, including use of the National Guard, as well as a lot of logistical support from healthcare providers and others in addition to the Guard, to help collect samples and to make sure that the laboratory capacity on the back end can process those samples quickly and get the results back. To date, the Guard has been helpful to us in more than 51 long-term care facilities. An additional 140 facilities report that they've done their own full facility testing using their own clinical staff or an existing provider partnership with one of the clinics or healthcare systems. Collectively, nearly 200 facilities and 26,000 individuals have been swabbed and tested in the last 3 weeks. And more than 53 more facilities are scheduled for initial or follow-up swabbing over the next 2 weeks, because you don't only do this testing once. You need to do it at an interval. The CDC recommends at 7 and 14 days at least in follow-up to the kind of the baseline testing. So we're going to be doing a lot of testing for a long time to come in these facilities. Next slide, please. So to get this testing to happen is really quite a process, and we've been working hard to reduce the barriers so that facilities have an easier time getting this testing done on their own or with our support. There's been a lot of complications around billing, the lack of ordering physicians in some facilities that don't have medical directors on site, et cetera. We've put a lot of material out into the field to help facilities prepare for testing so that it's not just a matter of getting the tests, but the follow-up of what needs to happen when positive results come back. We've rolled out a survey tool where facilities can sign up and request to be scheduled for testing in their facilities. More than 500 facilities have come through that system to get scheduled for testing. You see here about 200 of them say they will do testing on their own, and some of them are requesting supplies to support that testing or a swabbing team. Even for the ones where they say they're doing it on their own, they may need some logistical support for that. The other 300 will be done with the resources that I've described through the Guard or other swabbing teams from our partners. But as you can see, a lot of testing is going on. And as we keep saying, the more we ramp up testing, particularly when we're testing in known high-risk situations, we expect to find more positives. And that's a good thing. That's the whole point, to find the positives so that we can follow up. Next slide, please. We've also been providing weekly webinars for long-term care facilities since March, and they're well attended. Usually between 1,000 and 1,500 facilities are on the line every week for, you know, making sure that the guidance is clear as things have changed, that people, this is a weekly check-in opportunity for folks to get their questions answered and for us to be able to make sure that that evolving guidance is clearly communicated, including a couple weeks ago, a session to talk about the revised testing protocol and the system for getting that done. I mentioned the support of the Guard, which has been tremendous, 60 Guard members, and these are clinical folks. These are Guard members with some clinical background who have been trained on this particular COVID-19 swabbing requirement to test in long-term care facilities. And so the teams of Guard members have the capacity to test up to 2,000 people per each day. And additional Guard members are being trained as we speak to increase that capacity. Because we've got a lot of testing to do, a lot of facilities, and then the repeat testing. So we're trying to build up this capacity to be able to support that level of testing. You know, and I understand it's one thing to say, well, we need to test everybody, and that is the goal. We need to test everybody that needs to be tested. But the reality of the logistics that it takes to actually do that and do it, you know, in the repeated fashion that is required, is a very very complicated process. And I talk to colleagues around the country all the time, all of whom are you know, pretty much working under the same goal to do a lot more testing in long-term care. And I'm pretty proud of the fact that I think we're actually further ahead in achieving that than most other states. Next one, please. Personal protective equipment. This continues to be a real challenge. As I mentioned, the group at the State Emergency Operations Center, Critical Care Supplies, began working in mid-March. And early on, because of the really difficult challenges of sourcing PPE due to just the continuing global competition for that, our standards were pretty tight. We required facilities to be really, really in a pretty dire situation, a crisis inventory situation, before the state would fulfill their requests for PPE. As things have improved, we've relaxed that, and we're now able to fulfill requisitions from facilities when they're short, but they've got a little bit more lead time before they run out. And we're currently averaging between 80 and 100 shipments out to long-term care each day. The state's PPE warehouse inventory, as I think I already mentioned, this is intended to supplement the usual private sector supply chains. So that is, that needs to continue happening. It is continuing to happen, and the state warehouse really is the backstop. And we are expecting all facilities, acute care and long-term care, to use the conservation guidelines that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have issued and that MDH has endorsed. So we are going to need to continue to be very careful in managing the PPE supply, to conserve it where it's possible. Next one, please. And we have been doing our best to be not only reactive, but proactive in pushing supplies of PPE out to long-term care providers to kind of pre-position it around the state for easier access to them, and to get PPE quickly to any facility that is in need with an identified outbreak. We've, as you see here, received about 1,400 requests from facilities for help with PPE. About 62% of those have been fulfilled. And long-term care accounts for over half of the total number of requests that this system gets, and the remainder being from hospitals, clinics, and the like. And so you can see here the specific things that have been distributed to long-term care. 126,000 cloth masks, 605,000 face masks, 110,000 face shields or eye protection, 3.4 million gloves, 100,000 gowns or gown alternatives, and 108,095 or similar respirators. So a fair amount of equipment has gone out to the long-term care sector, and we know it's still a challenge. We still hear from facilities that they are feeling very concerned about the level of PPE that they will need to manage expected continued growth in cases. So we continue to work on improving that supply. Next one. Staffing has, as we all know, been a chronic challenge in this field among these providers, and is just exacerbated by staff getting ill, needing to isolate or quarantine if they've been exposed. It's just making a tough situation really tough. So what we've been doing is we built a volunteer management system that makes it easier for us to get volunteer healthcare workers, whether they're, you know, current, active or retired healthcare workers who are willing to help in their usually close to home facilities. So we've got a way of matching volunteers with need there, and we're working hard to build up the capacity to fulfill more and more of those requests for coverage of specific shifts. And we have, through the State Emergency Operations Center, been working hard to help, in addition to the volunteer staff, to deploy federal resources and National Guard resources to fill some shifts that sometimes happen just with almost no notice on an emergency basis. Next one. Leveraging our partnerships, we have developed, I think, just an extraordinarily good and detailed long-term care toolkit, which has now actually been cited by the Federal Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response as a national best practice document to help long-term care facilities be better prepared and to better manage cases when they evolve. And that's been out in the field, I think, for a couple of weeks now. We've also, at the beginning, I mentioned that we have nurse case managers assigned to all facilities, but earlier on, that was all MDH, all at the state health department level. And we're evolving that model now to include more reliance on local public health, where they have the capacity to do that, and the regional preparedness coalitions to get more connected to those facilities so that long-term care is fully included in all of the regional preparedness and coordination and sharing that is going on around the state. We've been very focused on infection control. We've been consulting with over 654 facilities on infection control, how to use PPE. That's been a big issue. Access to PPE is a challenge, but you also have to know how to properly put it on and take it off in order to have that be maximally protective for the staff and the residents. Next slide, please. We have, as I mentioned, done technical assistance visits with over 207 facilities and more scheduled all the time. And we've redeployed a lot of MDH staff, particularly in the health regulation division. We have a lot of nurses in the health regulation division who do the regulatory surveys, complaint investigations, and so forth. And about more than 80%, I think it's 90% now, of that clinically trained staff has been deployed to COVID support. Next slide, please. One very specific thing I know you wanted to talk about was hospital chart discharges and transfers. That's been a hotly discussed topic in the press. I know you have questions about it. Families have questions about it. We understand that. What we can share with you, though, is that we do not have any data that confirms that an outbreak started because of transfers of a COVID positive patient from a hospital. none of the epi investigations have traced an outbreak back to a transfer from a hospital. It's much more likely that transmission is coming from workers and others coming and going from facilities, just given the degree of community spread that's out there. Nationally, there's strong correlations that the primary drivers of higher rates of infection are large facility size and presence in counties with higher prevalence rates. Again, no correlation found in this study between transfers between acute and long-term care. It's also important to remember that CMS regulations say that a nursing home can accept a resident diagnosed with COVID-19, whether that's a transfer from a hospital or from another facility, only if the facility can follow CDC guidance for transmission-based precautions, which means things like being able to isolate positive people in single rooms, single bathrooms, co-locating positive people in one part of the facility and trying to isolate that from the rest of the facility and so forth. Next one. So again, here are those CMS requirements for staff with PPE, how staff are to interact with COVID positive patients, the fact that staff need to implement universal use of face masks, every staff all wear recommended PPE when caring for all residents on the unit or facility-wide based on where the affected residents have been, regardless of symptoms. As I mentioned, the cohorting, the MDH guidance has been people need to be isolated in the facility with single rooms and bathrooms. We have completed on-site visits, inspection visits, regulatory visits for CMS guidance of all 362 nursing homes in Minnesota over the late winter and spring, with a special focus on infection control, and did issue 163 deficiencies on those visits. One other point that just it is important to remember in this discussion of where should COVID-positive people go. Those individuals who are in the hospital have rights upon discharge. They have rights to choose a facility. They have rights to return to their home. And MDH does not have regulatory authority to interfere with the person's choice of facility. Next slide, please. Next one. Or maybe is this the end? Could be the last slide. Yep, it is. So I know I've talked longer than intended, but that was a lot to get through, Madam Chair. Hopefully we anticipated or addressed most of the questions that you had identified before, but I'm sure you have others. So with that, let's open it up.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Commissioner. So members, I do have a list of folks for questions, but I would really like to, if we have one other testifier, and that's Dr. Emily Downing, who's testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association. And she is going to talk a little bit, I hope, about what the commissioner kind of ended with, which is the discharges of COVID positive or COVID recovering patients from hospitals. So I'd like to let her get through that presentation and then open it up for questions. Let me just tell you who's on the list so that you'll know that you're there if you are. So we've got Schultz, Munson, Keel, Jordan, Cantrell, Grinhagen, and Franson. So if you do have a question, go ahead and put your hand up, and the staff is keeping track. So with that, I would like to go to Dr. Downing. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Downing. If you just introduce yourself briefly, and then please go ahead.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to sharing with you and answering any of your questions. I am a practicing physician. I specialize in geriatric medicine. I'm also a health system leader at Allina Health, and a lot of my role is patient flow across the whole continuum of care, partnering closely with our discharge planners and our discharge practices from the hospital. I've been very fortunate over the last decade of practice to practice in long-term care and assisted living facilities, probably more than 30 in our community. I've been a physician at some point in time, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association. I would like to talk about COVID-19 with you, which is the topic of the day here most days. As you know, it really causes severe respiratory conditions, and the nature of which really impacts our elderly more, and as well as those with underlying health conditions. And our goal as healthcare providers is to provide Minnesotans with the right setting for the care they need, which means delivering the right care at the right time and in the right place. That could include care in the hospital, rehabilitation, a nursing home, or any other care setting. And it's the hospital's responsibility to transition our patients back into the community to a more appropriate care setting when their inpatient physician determines that they are ready to be discharged and no longer need that hospital level of care. That helps us preserve space in our hospitals for patients who need hospital care, helps us reduce the cost of health care by using those very high cost acute care services for when those patients really need them, and to prevent our patients from getting hospital acquired in conditions or other infections that they could get in the hospital. And for our seniors especially, when they're in the hospital, they can become very weak takes them, some say, you know, in geriatric 7 days to recover from every day that they spend in the inpatient setting.
Dr. Downing, if I could just interrupt you for 1 second, we're getting a little interference, and I wonder if you're touching your microphone with papers or something.
Oh, sorry.
I think it's okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Please continue.
So patients really receiving the right care in the right place is what's best for them. So COVID-19 patients, like all our other patients, are released from our inpatient settings only after their acute care needs have been met. And again, from Alina's perspective, I've been partnering very closely with our discharge planners, which I think is very similar to what else is happening in the community. Hospitals aren't discharging our COVID patients too early right now. COVID-19 patients are on average remaining longer in our hospital settings than patients without COVID-19. And there's tremendous focus from our hospitals to make sure those COVID patients are in the hospital for the right amount of time, knowing that those COVID-19 patients are in our hospitals for longer. Our patients are anxious to get out of the hospital. Even those with COVID-19, they're anxious to get to the next setting of care that will best meet their needs, whether that's in a nursing home, a rehab facility, or home services. I wanted to highlight for you, and similar to what the commissioner highlighted for you, some of the Department of Health's recommendations for guidance for hospital discharge to home or admissions to congregate living settings and discontinuing transmission-based precautions. And our hospitals are definitely following this guidance. So hospital discharge planners are required to provide notice to that congregate living setting for transfer of any patient with confirmed or suspected COVID. And then there are instructions on how to prevent transmission after discharge from the hospital to a congregate setting. And this is for, and they list all these different categories: patients with confirmed or suspected COVID, persons under investigation with test results pending, persons investigated with a negative test, and patients with no clinical concerns for COVID-19. As you hear that list, you realize those are all patients that is included there. And the recommendations there are that all of these individuals are quarantined and in isolation for 14 days after transfer to a facility, and that all of these individuals be placed in a single room with a private bathroom. And if facilities can't meet that or that requirement, or the use of personal protective equipment, all the things that the commissioner talked about, facilities aren't required to take those patients. So that's different than things we've seen in other states right now that other parts of the country are responding to. There is discretion at the hand of the facility to make sure they can adequately take care of those patients upon transfer. Our hospitals really are going to great effort to ensure that they are seeing patients go to the right level of care and into an environment that they are going to be taken care of well. There are still challenges, many of in that 5-point battle plan that still need further work. And I think we all would agree that further work is needed. Those include testing. So reducing asymptomatic spread in our congregate settings must be a priority. We really need to focus the state's testing capacity on long-term care residents and its workforce. Community spread is very prevalent in our long-term care workers that are asymptomatic. They could be coming to work without knowing they have COVID. And we need to make this a priority before general testing of the other population. The volume of testing required, and the commissioner talked about that, is very, very large. And getting that amount of testing materials and supplies, the staff to do those testing, should really be a top priority. The infection prevention and personal protective equipment support needs to be another main priority. There's been a ton of work done around this already, and it needs to continue to progress. And there's more work that needs to be done still. Early on, the Department of Health had discussed the idea of nursing facility site identification, specifically for those that could best meet needs of COVID-19 or COVID suspect patients. We've called those cohort sites. And so those are nursing homes. They could have a separate physical wing or space for caring for potential or COVID diagnosed patients during their illness, as well as during their isolation period. That provides a lot of safety, not only for those COVID patients and other residents in our community, but also for staff, when you can really have that very heightened level of expertise and focus on infection prevention. And I think it's worth still really discussing those cohort site options. We have a few in our community, but to my knowledge, they have not been formally integrated into an actionable plan at a state level. And I've been proud to help launch one of those in my role in Allina Health. And I just like to end with saying that it is our community's responsibility to really rally and support our long-term care providers with resources to support these ongoing challenges. They are vital community assets. Many are going to great lengths to aid and lead the community in the pandemic response. And it's been a privilege for me to partner with them and the hospitals to provide care across the care continuum during this time. And thank you so much for your time and your commitment to public service.
Well, Dr. Downing, thank you very much for being with us today and for that presentation. So if you could stay with us, it would be great. I know the commissioner has to be in another meeting at 1 o'clock. So we're gonna, I have a lot of members on the list with questions. And so members, I'm gonna read you the list again because it's gotten longer and it's changed a little bit, and then we're gonna get started. But I would just ask everyone to please be concise in your questions, and please make them questions. This is not, you know, we're really on a short time frame here, and we, in fairness to let all the members get to their questions, let's try to be a little bit concise. And if you have them for the commissioner, let's try to start with those since she has to go sooner. So we've got Schultz, Munson, Keel, Cantrell, Grinhagen, Franson, Bierman, Knorr, and Mason. So quite a long list. So Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I have a lot of questions. I'll limit it to one at first, and maybe we can come back to me at the end. But first of all, I just want to highlight all the important work that MDH is doing right now that the public isn't aware of, and many of our members are not. So there's a lot of protocols and guidelines and checklists they're using to make sure they have infection control underway at nursing facilities and other settings, and to deal with the safe transfer of patients from a hospital. So I just wanted to highlight that, and some of that was in the slide deck. But my question is, if testing is a priority, and I'm concerned that not all facilities are able to test their staff or their residents, especially if staff are uninsured and they have no way to cover those tests. So I'm wondering if the commissioner has any guidance or ideas for how we can cover staff for their testing costs. I know I don't think we're charging for the lab tests that are going to Mayo or the University of Minnesota, but what about just administering the test? Are facilities covering it if they have staff that are uninsured? Are health plans, health insurers who are actually doing well right now, are they putting up money to test in long-term care facilities? So do you have any comments on that?
I'd invite any of my colleagues who are on the phone, Assistant Commissioner Dotseth or anybody else to chime in here too. But we are putting together kind of a macro financing plan for all of this testing. I mean, the state's commitment is that where there are barriers to testing, we will fill in that barrier. So yes, it's always optimal if people go through their regular healthcare provider and their insurance system. The health plans in Minnesota have agreed to waive copays, as you know, and we appreciate that. But yes, we have sources of state funds. We've given with some of the grants that the legislature appropriated that have gone out to healthcare providers, including long-term care, are to support things like testing. So there are just many different pots of money to tap, reimbursement from the federal government, some of the state sources, but it can be a pretty complex patchwork to point people to the right source of financial support, so that we definitely have work to do to kind of simplify that system. But our commitment is that financial barriers will not be the reason why facilities can't get tested.
Thank you, Commissioner. And just one follow-up, Chair Liebling. So are you collecting information from those facilities that are struggling with testing? Is this part of the assessment you're doing of the long-term care facilities?
Marie or anybody else, can you speak to what information we have on financial barriers for facilities?
Hold on.
This is Chris Ayersman, and I'll say that right now facilities that are interested in testing fill out a red cap survey and are put into a queue, and then there's a team of people that works with them to talk to them about what their needs are related to testing. So they will work that through. And as the commissioner said, we're aware of some of the challenges related to staff testing. And so that is being discussed by the committees, the teams that are working on standing up a robust long-term care testing strategy. But the facilities who are interested in testing, there's a process for them to indicate their interest. And then there's a team that works with them on some of the details. And so if that is an issue, then we can start working through that with them.
Thank you.
Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Malcolm, in your presentation on slides 6 and 7, you stated that the direct comparison between other states can be misleading. But you've altered our numbers so that you're reporting to reduce the number of cases and deaths to be only skilled nursing facilities and not other congregate care facilities. I think it's important to compare apples to apples when we're looking at numbers of other states, but can you confirm that all the other states listed in slides are comparing only long-term care facilities and they're not including group homes and assisted living facilities and memory care and transitional care, substance abuse, mental health facilities? Because if they are continuing to report, or some states are continuing to report numbers like we were, then it's still not the numbers continue to be misleading.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, these slides are skilled nursing facilities only. This data comes from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, so they are collecting nursing home-only data for this data source. We do and will continue to report all long-term care cases and deaths in our daily reports and on our website. So we are not losing track of the cases and the mortality in those other settings. But this is just the direct skilled nursing facility to skilled nursing facility comparison for all states.
Okay. And Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. The data, for Alzheimer's patients that the recommendations from them, concerns around the patient privacy information. Is there going to be a change, or has there already been made a change to share the data for patients or the number of patients in these facilities to a wider audience, or is that change not been made yet?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, I am going to ask for some help from my colleagues here with respect to a specific request from the Alzheimer's Association. The question of what is reported publicly, what we've been doing, as you may know, is posting facilities with over 10 cases on the website out of concern for protection of personal privacy. So we've been reporting facilities with more than 10 cases publicly. I'm not sure if that was your question, though.
Yep.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Commissioner. It's really just around the Minnesota Health Records Act and making sure that if we're putting any changes in place and rulemaking that that we, you know, have advance notice on these changes and to make sure that patients have the ability to opt out of sharing this information if that's what they'd like to do. I'll look forward to more information later. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Munson. I share that concern, and I think there's across the legislature, there's been push and pull on that, I must say, on that very issue. Okay, Representative Keel. Representative Keel, we're not hearing you. Are you unmuted?
There we go. How's
there
that?
There we go. There we go.
I apologize. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions. I just want to clarify, first of all, when you're referring to the outbreak in a facility, are you including the staff with those facilities? And how many are end up being staff only? Do you have any way to know that?
Commissioner?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Keel, yes, we do collect and data for both staff and residents, and we do have that data. Chris may have it at her fingertips. She is amazing with her her detailed data knowledge. Chris, can you confirm the staff versus residents?
Ms. Arisman.
Yep, Commissioner and Chair Liebling and Representative Keel. We have 371 facilities that have only reported a staff or healthcare worker case. So of the 872 facilities that we're reporting, 371 have only healthcare worker cases, 121 have only resident cases, and 332 have both resident and healthcare worker cases.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that because I'm seeing some of my facilities that's basically what we're getting is staff not, and they're able to catch it before they're in the building working. So I think that really helps to minimize the outbreak in some of our facilities. I was trying not to double up on what other people asked. How are you able to isolate the dementia, Alzheimer's? I know the privacy of information, usually a family is giving some okays to have things done. Are they being contacted when a test is done so that they know that their loved one is being tested? And then how is that being handled? That can't be simple.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, Chris, can you comment on the notification protocol?
Sure, Commissioner, and Chair Liebling and Representative Keel. The process is to obtain informed consent or consent from the resident. And so in cases where the resident is unable to give consent, then it would be the proxy, the family member. And that is why when it comes to standing up testing in these facilities that they need a little bit of time to be able to prepare for the testing that's done. They can't just sort of do it on a dime because there is that necessary reaching out to family members. But that is the process. So there is consent given by residents and staff, and if the resident is unable, then they would reach out to the family member.
Okay.
So, Ms. Arisman, when you test, are you making sure that the family is notified if that's a positive test?
Ms. Arisman?
Chair Liebling and Representative Keel, the results are provided back by the provider who has ordered the testing, And so it's not coming from the Department of Health, so I can't exactly speak to that, but my understanding would be that if the individual themselves was unable to process their result, that then that would be shared with the guardian or family member that could.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Keel. So we've got Cantrell, Grunhagen, Franson, Bierman, Knorr, Mason, and Haley. Let's see if we can get through in 10 minutes. Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Dr. Downey, if she is still on the call or still in the meeting. Just wanted to kind of circle back to something that you mentioned about the prolonged amount of time that it takes for a geriatric patient to recover after discharge from hospital, proportional to the amount of days that they spend in the hospital. So it's my understanding that actually the longer amount of time that they spend in the hospital beyond just acute care can be and is demonstrably detrimental to their overall health and well-being and recovery. Is that a correct interpretation of what you mentioned, Dr. Downey?
Dr. Downing?
Yeah, so post-hospital syndrome, it's well documented. And to get strength back after being bedbound, there's definitely therapy in the hospital, but it's not the type of rehabilitation, the mobility, activity, cognition, all those things that need to go into a recovery for our seniors does take a significant amount of time and longer the longer they're in the hospital.
Thanks, Cantrell. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Downey. And then this is my last question. To Director Ayersman, I believe in the governor's press conferences, you've mentioned that that compared to the quality of testing and data reporting collection in other states, Minnesota is perhaps more adept at making sure that our data and our results and the thoroughness of our testing are more complete than maybe in other states and the practices that we pursue to obtain that data. Would you mind just touching briefly on that? I'm just curious how the quality of our data collection and reporting compares to that of other states in terms of actually having a more robust and comprehensive picture of the trajectory of this disease within long-term care facilities in particular.
Ms. Ayersman?
Chair Liebling and Representative Cantrell, yes, I think that the commissioner touched on this, but Minnesota does have a good reputation for having very strong data. So as an example, we tend to have more foodborne outbreaks than anywhere else in the country. That's not because Minnesota has more problems related to foodborne disease, but simply that we have a very strong surveillance system to identify disease. And I feel that is the same situation as it relates to long-term care. As the commissioner mentioned, starting with our very first cases in these facilities, we made it a priority to do focused testing and make sure at the time when testing resources were limited, that we were focusing them on our most vulnerable populations. So yes, I do feel that the same high level of surveillance that you've seen for vaccine preventable disease, foodborne and other infectious diseases is true with long-term care. And that's why we feel that, you know, while we know we have work to do, we do feel that we're doing a good job of capturing the challenges that we're facing related to our long-term care settings.
Thank you, Director Ayersman. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and everyone who's working on this.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner, did you have something you wanted to add?
No, Madam Chair. I'm good.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. You go to the website of MDH, you got plenty of PPE equipment, hundreds of thousands, if not millions in some cases. So I don't see why there should be shortage, but I'll get to my question. You know, I have a relative who manages a senior living center in New Hope, and within their district or area, they have two long-term care policies, and of course, that's where they introduced COVID-19 patients. A short while later, they had 30 to 40 deaths in those nursing homes, which they never had before. So I don't know why we're putting COVID-19 patients into nursing homes with our most vulnerable when we have in rural Minnesota spent millions of dollars getting ready for COVID-19 in our medical facilities, and there's no patients. They could go into a swing bed or anything like that. Personally, to tell you the truth, whoever made the decision to stick these COVID-19 patients into nursing homes, I'd fire them, to tell you the truth, and get somebody else. And here we sit with the rural hospitals, basically empty, laying off people and going bankrupt because they don't have any patients. Why are we doing that?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, you raise a really good point about how can we best use the capacity, perhaps differently from region to region. You know, again, I think just the points that have been made about whether an acute care setting is the best setting for these patients from Dr. Downing and others, but we are in fact looking at swing bed strategies where we are absolutely continuing to be in dialogue with the provider, with the providers themselves, as well as consumer advocates and geriatric leaders, like Dr. Downing and others, to continue to get smarter about this and to keep talking about what additional strategies can we use above and beyond the strategies that are we strongly believe are having success in controlling these outbreaks in many of these facilities.
Well, you're killing nursing home people, and quite frankly, I'd fire the person who decided to put them in there. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. I think that is, while I might not agree with your underlying premise, I think you are asking the right question here. And what I understood the commissioner to say before is that there really isn't any evidence that any of the outbreaks have come from people who've been discharged from hospitals. But the concern is a good one, and I think that the commissioner is hearing that concern. Commissioner, did you want to say any more, or Dr. Downing, did you want to say any more about that issue? Because I think that is a really key issue here.
Chair Liebling, I like to respond to that. So it's the CDC is creating these guidelines, Representative Grunhagen. And so if you want to hold someone accountable, I guess it would be the CDC and President Trump.
Yeah, but we got a brain, don't we? And we have Cuomo mandating in New York. It's like he wants to run the score up. At least we didn't mandate it here, but we're doing the same thing. We're killing these people. You can think that through. And that's enough of that crap.
Well, okay. You know what? We have other people on the list here. So I think that your concern is well taken, Representative Grunhagen, and this certainly bears a lot more discussion, and I hope we will have a lot more of that. And I think it's good for the department to be hearing that concern from you. Representative Franson, you are muted. Can't hear you.
Okay.
There we go.
I'm a little out of practice. Happy Friday, everybody. It's really nice to be in front of you, and I'm glad after many, many weeks of this being talked about that we are having this hearing here. So thank you, Madam Chair. And I too want to echo the sentiments of my colleague, Representative Grunhagen. You know, we value life, and I see that life has not been exactly valued under the COVID guidelines in nursing homes. And in my opinion, instead of the state buying what I term to be the mega morgue, millions of dollars spent to store dead bodies that, of course, will never be in there because we're not going to need it, we should have been putting those millions of dollars into protecting our grandmas and grandpas in nursing homes. With that said, Commissioner Malcolm, I am holding a letter from Senator Karen Housley that was sent to you on June 4th. I've got it here. I printed it out. And it has 17 questions on it that is due by 5 p.m. today. My question to you, Commissioner Malcolm, is the department going to get the answers to Senator Housley that have been sent to you by the deadline of 5 p.m. today.
So I'm going to ask Commissioner to not answer that question because I think it's outside the scope of this hearing. No. And whether she does or doesn't, I think you could ask her that offline. And if she does or doesn't, we'll see, I guess, by the end of today. So I also have that letter. It came yesterday. And as you said, she had 17 questions. And whether the commissioner is prepared to answer that, I don't know. But I do know she has to get off this call at 1 o'clock. So I'm going to go on to, I don't know, Commissioner, are you hopping off or do you need to stay with us? Do you need to hop off or can you stay with us for a few more minutes? I'm not sure she's even still there. So I'm going to go on to Representative.
Chair, yes. Liebling, I just want to let you know, this is Chris Ayersman and yes. I am still here if you need questions
okay.
from the department.
Excellent. Thank you. Because I see Commissioner's name on the screen, but I don't see that she's actually present there. Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, sorry, this is Commissioner Malcolm. I thought I was unmuted. I am still here, but I do need to leave in just a minute, but I'm grateful that my staff can stay with you. I have to chair another meeting, but I've got maybe two more minutes.
Okay, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to first say thank you to the Commissioner and to the Director Ayersman and everyone who's working so hard on this. I appreciate the work you do, and I can't ask a question without saying that first. I do want to know some of the things about the guidelines for testing in care centers. Representative Schultz addressed one of the big ones that they're stumbling with is the financing to get testing paid. Another one I had a question on is whether it is a requirement that these facilities have to have 30% backup of people to come in before testing can commence. And then the final thing was just, what is the plan after an initial baseline testing? Does MDH have a policy on how often or how frequently, especially the workers in the facilities get tested on an ongoing basis?
Commissioner.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Bierman, thanks. I am going to leave that question to Chris, and I will take this opportunity to thank you all for your time and your deep commitment to working with us on these issues. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm sorry to have to run.
Thank
Hi
you,
there.
Commissioner.
How are you? Say this is Mary.
So, okay, Ms. Ayersman, go ahead.
Madam Chair and Representative Bierman, the 30% backup is not a requirement per se, but what we have found is that many facilities, when they do test all of their staff, can have as high as a 30% positivity. And so we want to make sure that before they do the testing, that they have a plan in place so that if staff need to be relieved from their duties because they are isolated, that we don't have a staffing crisis in addition to COVID. So it's not a hard, fast requirement, but it is something that we want to make sure that we've worked through with the facilities on. And then in terms of the plan for follow-up testing, as the commissioner alluded to, the recommendation is to do baseline testing and then testing again at 7 and 14 days. And then subsequent testing can continue after that. And our goal would be that we could work with facilities so that if there was additional testing needed, that they could do the swabbing themselves. What we have found and what we want to see is that as you continue to test and you're implementing infection control, that you're cohorting patients, doing all of those things, that you see that your positivity and the number of positives that you're finding drops off rather dramatically. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Bierman.
Yes, that helps a lot. And if I may, just one quick follow-up. Besides the cost of the testing on facilities and the staffing issue, what are the other key issues and obstacles you're finding most frequently for facilities that hesitate to do testing for any other reason?
Ms. Ayersman.
Chair Liebling and Representative Bierman, some of the challenges have to do with having a medical provider to write the order for testing. And I think the commissioner alluded to the fact that we were working on that. Sometimes it's just the logistics of, having the time to get all the names and get people together. So just the logistics of pulling staff together. Some of the things that we find challenging are just making sure that we get the information that we need, both from the testing laboratory as well as the facility. There are a lot of details, and as they say, the devil's in the details. And so sometimes those details can be challenging, but I think the cost, the staffing issues, some of those things, those are the bigger issues, and we have teams that are working on addressing those.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Director.
All right. Thank you. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just wanted to appreciate the work being done by the Department of Health as well. My question is a little bit slightly different. Number one is I just wanted to know, for those individuals who are in home setting, who are not in a facility setting, and getting programs through the state, are we tracking COVID-19 presence at that level? And secondly, do we have guidance when it comes to end-of-life care for individuals who have got COVID-19 in terms of someone being in a hospital setting or facility setting or in a home setting? Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Ms. Erisman? And maybe Dr. Downing could even jump in on this one, but Ms. Erisman, why don't you start, if you would?
Sure, Chair Liebling and Representative Knorr. In terms of, are we monitoring COVID in places other than, long-term care, congregate care settings? Yes, and as you heard, our definition of that is very broad, but if someone was in being cared for in a home setting and had, concerning symptoms, that yes, that would be someone that we would recommend get tested. I cannot speak to the fact that there is actually, say, individuals who go out to swab those individual patients in an individual living in their own home, but it is a situation where we would certainly recommend testing for that individual. And then I guess I will defer to Dr. Downing on the end of life question.
Thank you. Dr. Downing, can you address that at all?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative, thank you for the question. I also have the privilege to oversee our hospice program at Allina Health and end of life care practices. The recommendation for where care should occur if that patient is an end of life doesn't change based on the fact that they are end of life. It has to do with their COVID status. So the recommendation for where they would get care, whether in the home or in a facility, would be the level of care that they need. There are locations that will take hospice patients that do have infection prevention measures and ability to take care of COVID-19 patients. If a patient does want to return home, certainly providing the family with the necessary guidance on infection prevention in the home is critical, just as with discharging any COVID patient back to the home. And what I can say is that our hospice program is doing COVID testing. So if a patient is enrolled in hospice, our staff will provide COVID testing for that patient in the home setting, if that comes up as a concern.
Representative Knorr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll follow up later on with the department and also some of the institutions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Downing. Representative Mason? And we're not hearing you, Representative Mason. You need to unmute.
Sorry about that.
There you go.
I think my question about why the other states were concentrating on reporting nursing homes has been answered. So what I'm going to ask is about the testing or swabbing in the senior homes. I've got quite a number of senior and variety of senior housing in my district, and one of them does have a number of COVID cases that has come up recently. One of the residents had gone outside for health issues and is now living with her sister because she's supposedly not supposed to go back into the into her house at this point, which I think is unusual. Whereas in another facility, the woman also had a health issue, but she is in quarantine in her senior housing deal. So is there a, so it sounds like there's not a comprehensive or direct way to go this to this. Is that correct? And how often does the swabbing have to be done? Because the woman that lived in the first place, she was up, she really wants more swabbing, because I know the staff was they were using the temperature and doing other protocols as well prior to the COVID.
Ms. Erisman?
Chair Liebling and Representative Mason. So a couple of things. One is that it's great that the facilities that you're talking about were doing early screening before testing was widely available. That was something that we really wanted to see. That was a good way for facilities to try and keep a tab on what might be happening. Right now, we are trying to make testing more available, as you've heard. And so these facilities, if they're interested in participating in testing, can go to, well, hopefully they're participating in the calls that we have, but they can go to the REDCap database and sign themselves up. When you were talking about the question of someone living with their sister or someone else returning to their residence and then being in quarantine, the recommendations that the department has have to do with individuals who have tested positive or been exposed to COVID specifically. I do know that some facilities, you know, if someone's been out of the facility, they make a recommendation that the individual be quarantined within the facility. And so I don't know if the individual living with their sister just chose to do that rather than be quarantined. It depends on how the facility wants to, I guess, handle that situation. But we are making swabbing more available. And if facilities are interested, we can help them sign up. So I guess if you have the names of these facilities, we can get those from you and we can work with them.
Okay, sounds
good. All right, thank you.
The woman that is living outside her facility, she was tested for COVID and she said she was tested negative. And her husband is still in the facility.
Okay, well, that sounds like a situation that may be a little topsy-turvy, and it may be a situation in which we could reach out to you and work with that particular situation offline and specifically, but could it possibly help with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. All right. Representative Haley, didn't think we were going to get to you, but we have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my questions are around the PPE. You know, we keep hearing about PPE being a challenge. And so I just would like it if Ms. Erisman can get more specific on, is the issue the national supply chain and getting product into Minnesota? Is the issue our state supply chain and getting it to facilities that request it? Is the issue releasing equipment from our stockpile? I would like to know how the prioritization happens from the stockpile when a long-term care facility requests PPE. Just do we have kind of the root cause analysis and the solution for this issue? Because it keeps coming up and I haven't heard from anybody how we solve it. Thank you so much.
Ms. Erisman?
Chair Liebling and Representative Haley, and I'm going to invite Assistant Commissioner Dot Seth to also weigh in. I can tell you that initially, when we were relying on some of the federal supplies of PPE, some of them had very specific rules, if you will, as to how they could be utilized. And so that was a challenge early on. At this point, we do have more PPE, but it's interesting. For a while, we were having difficulty obtaining masks, and then it shifted to gowns, and then sometimes it'll shift to another piece of the PPE. So in other words, there are many parts to what is necessary to provide protection for a healthcare worker. And we certainly have focused on masks, but there are other parts of that. And so it was a little bit like whack-a-mole for a while, where we didn't have the masks and we had the gowns, and then we didn't have the gowns and we had the masks. And so that has been the challenge. I can tell you that one of the things that we did do, you heard us talk about the COVID case managers. And in order to request PPE, there's a bit of a process. And so one of the things that our COVID case managers do is they work with facilities to help streamline that. So the last thing you need to be thinking about when you're dealing with an outbreak is filling out necessary paperwork to make a request. And so the case managers have helped with that to make it more readily accessible. But I'll see if Assistant Commissioner Dotsett has any additional comments.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Madam Chair and Representative Bailey, I think Chris said it well, and I'll just reiterate what the Commissioner said in her presentation. We are still facing a worldwide shortage of PPE. And so we are working fast and furious to obtain what we can, when we can, and that's coordinated through the State Emergency Operations Center. And as Director Ehrsman said, there's a process for doing that, and it's those kind of in most urgent need get their requests fulfilled first. But as Commissioner Malcolm mentioned again in her presentation, there have been proactive pushes of PPE out to long-term care facilities, so they didn't have to even request that. There is PPE going out. There are emergency supplies of PPE out into the regions so that when outbreaks occur, facilities can get that very quickly. But I guess the overarching thing is that there still is a worldwide shortage that we're trying to manage.
All right. Thank you very much. So we are about out of time. Chair Schultz wanted to have a final word, I think, and then we're going to wrap it up here. Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I just want to reemphasize the importance of this meeting and changing the narrative that Minnesota is not doing worse than other states. We're sort of in the middle on number of cases and number of deaths in our skilled nursing facilities. And something that wasn't mentioned is other states are not only not reporting all of the congregate living settings, deaths and cases, is that there's a variation how the report of a death occurs in the hospital or a facility where it's attributed to. So our numbers are probably a lot lower than other states if you factor that in. But I just want to say that it's pretty amazing that MDH is working with over 650 facilities right now on infection control and other issues. For a small agency, this is pretty amazing. So we really need to lift them up and give them the resources MDH needs to continue working with facilities and reducing the number of deaths and the number of cases. So I just want to thank them again for everything they're doing, and hopefully we can help get resources where they're needed.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. And I just would like to thank, first of all, Dr. Downing for being with us. And as a representative of hospitals across the state, thank you all for your work. And this has been a very challenging time for everyone, especially those who are really on the front lines of caring for these patients. So please accept all of our gratitude for all of the great work that you and your colleagues are doing. And then thank you very much to the Department of Health for being with us today and addressing some of our questions. I know we could spend hours more. There are many more questions to be asked and answered, but we know that you're extremely busy trying to actually deal with the emergency. And if members do have, you know, questions, we are, you know, happy to try to gather those and try to get answers to them as best we can facilitate that. So with no other business before the committee today, we are adjourned.